Kia ora, tā alofa, hi, and welcome to another episode of Tanarumanga's Team Talk, proudly sponsored by Victual, New Zealand's first health and wellbeing supplement range that combines ancient Māori and Pacifica wisdom and ingredients. And my guest tonight started his career in Canberra, signing with the ACT Brumbies Academy at the age of 14 and 9 months. There's a bit of story behind that. He's a former Australian captain at under 19 level, where he led them to a world championship. He made his debut for the Brumbies in Super Rugby in 2006. And after 5 years with them, he moved to warmer climates in Brisbane and signed with the Reds in 2009. He debuted for the Wallabies against Fiji in 2010, going on to play 42 times. And he made history when he was named in the starting lineup along with his brother Anthony against the All Blacks in Christchurch when they became the first set of twins since Mark and Glenn Eller to start for the Wallabies in a test. He won a Super Rugby title with the Reds in 2011 and went on to make the Wallabies squad for the 2011 World Cup. My guest retired in 2021 after a stint in England with London Irish and has gone on to become the managing director of 100% Indigenous-owned and operated companies, Munya Services, Munya Workforce, and Maggi Furniture. He's also co-founded a charity with his twin brother, Anthony, and they aim to raise much-needed awareness and funds for breast cancer research. He's very proud of his Aboriginal and Tongan heritage and is always willing to help out in these communities. Welcome, Saia Whanga'a. It's good to have you on, bro. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Geez, that's a long intro. Bringing me back to the Stone Ages there.
Oh, hey, I've got to tell the whole story. Got to tell the whole story. You've achieved so much. And now, you know, we were just talking, man, and that story about signing with the Academy for when you were 14, let's hear that. It's a good way to start.
It is a good way to start. So I think, you know, when even now the academies, you know, you have the junior academies and then, you know, then you've got your senior academies and then you've got something else. Like, when I first started, and a bit like yourself, we started and there was no junior academy, there was no, you know, under 18s. It was, you were playing with the big boys. So I remember being 14, 9 months or nearly 15 years old. And I was, you know, I was essentially training with the guys that were getting ready for the Brumbies squad. And I'm like this little pup and all these bullies. Literally, they're talking about nutritional, they're talking about, you know, their diet, they're talking about, you know, they've got to do like a yo-yo, or they've got all these big expectations. I'm like, man, I'm just straight, I'm like in school, I'm in year nine. How am I going to bloody hit like these 130 kilo guys? Or I was like, it's going to be a long day today. So, but yeah, it was a good, I suppose, because both Anthony and I had that exposure with them. As a young age, both Anthony and I played for First 15 Young. And you see young Pacific Islanders specifically, you know, now that they get exposed to First 15, level First 15, or, you know, being exposed to, you know, Super Rugby at age 16, 17, 18 years old. So for us, we didn't think, you know, anything different, where now they're kind of baby, you know, the younger generation. And, you know, how are you supposed to build men if they get looked after, I guess? But then also, you know, we have to nurture our young guys so that they can get body hardened and make sure that they facilitate the gym. You know, I was doing four gym sessions a week at age 15. I was doing conditioning, fitness. It was quite funny because the Venga boys just came out then.
Yeah.
And so my mum, we had this old beaten up Tarago. And the boys would always say, oh, the Fango bus is coming. And it was pretty funny because obviously we had the taxi, like, you know, my mum was a taxi service for all five boys. So, but yeah, it was a pretty funny stories there.
Yeah, well, you can imagine all the boys, especially when you're training with the fully professional guys and they're all driving there themselves and in their flash cars and you're pulling up with a Fango bus. Hey, we've got to take our hats off to our parents for everything they do for us, though, don't they?
Yeah, or my mum, like, she was the rock solid of our family, and I don't think we would have been as successful as what we were without her. So, I always say, like, do you talk to your mum often? So talk to my mum every day. It's kind of weird, but all of us boys do. And I think because she was such a big part of our life with our food and nutritional, you know, it was, you know, I remember we met with a dietitian, and because we're so young, they're like, boys, like, you know, do you cook? And I'm like, why would I cook? Mum's at home. Like, silly question. So then we had to go to the nutritional meetings with my mum. So my mum had to sit in all our meetings. And, you know, so we went from like deep fried chicken to like grilled meat. It was like the worst day of my life though. You know, we went from, you know, chocolate smoothies to like banana smoothies. And the nutritionist like, oh, Cindy, you know, you've got to change it, the way that you cook. And my mum, like, because she loved cooking. So, but, you know, just not change, like when we have steaks, you know, we're steak and salad instead of steak and only potato. You know, so the portioning and you know, having five boys and, you know, all kind of playing rugby, it worked out for all of us. So, but she was the chef and the driver, the carer, and obviously she was everything. So,
whereabouts do you sit with your, you know, you and Anthony, whereabouts do you sit in the pecking order of your brothers? Are you the oldest?
Second oldest. So I'm five minutes. Older than Anthony, and then we've got an older brother called Siosi, and then we've got a middle brother, Vili, and then Colby.
I was just going to say, hey, being the older brother, then all of a sudden, what's all this stuff? Come home. What's this healthy stuff? What's happened to it?
I think our younger brothers hated us when we, the first day, you know, I remember we had chicken schnitzels and they were going from chicken schnitzels to we're not battering anymore, boys, you know, or, you know, we went from, you know, fried potatoes to like, you know, mashed potatoes or like just boiled potatoes. It was, and no one really liked us in the house after that.
Oh, I can imagine. You know, you're talking about, especially at a young age, what was it like, you know, obviously the Brumbies back then, you had some of the greats playing. What was it like actually interacting with them? You know, what was their style? You know what I mean? Yeah, because we've heard a lot about, you know, the way that older players used to talk to younger players, and the younger players, you know, you're not allowed to talk until you've been there a few years.
So we went to an era where we had George Greig and Stephen Larkin. We had, you know, George Smith. We had the best of the best. But what they did have, and you know, we'll probably elaborate it more later, but when I finished school, I thought I was a millionaire. Because I was signed with the Brumbies, I was a multimillionaire. You know, before, you know, my contract, my first rookie contract was, you know, 32 grand, but I was a millionaire. You know, I've made it. And then I saw these guys, you know, at a young age, you know, they had coffee shops, or they were, you know, hedge fund brokers, or they were directors of businesses, or and they were, you know, they were upskilling and being educated. And I was like, what are these guys doing? I'm like, what idiots? Like, for me as a Pacific, I was like, man, you should be playing rugby. You should earn, you know, earn all this money. And then what, they're going to go work for someone else? And then, you know, when – and I suppose the big, I suppose, turning point for us is when a player called Dave Pulavi, he broke his neck. And – I was the incumbent hooker, so there was Jeremy Paul, Dave Pulavi, and then was me. So I was always on the fringe for the two guys. And Jeremy Paul got injured, and then Dave Pulavi was there, and then he ended up breaking his neck. And I was like, this guy was supposed to take his spot. You know, he was supposed to be, you know, the guy that played for the Wallabies. And I looked up to David because he was such a great athlete. He was always under Jeremy Paul, but always worked so much harder. And yeah, he was like a big aspiration for me. And then when I saw that, I was like, maybe we might have to do something. And my father always pushed for us to be, obviously the rugby side, but always pushed to make sure that we had property or we owned our own house, or, you know, even if it was the smallest thing, but it was our house.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that still instills us, you know, it's probably, you know, he's like, say, you've got to pay the mortgage off straight away, you know, you've got to make sure you have zero debts. And, you know, obviously, you know, changes now, you know, with rental properties and, you know, diversifying and doing all the other stuff. But at that time, we didn't know any better. So we didn't have any money. We didn't have this. We didn't have, you know, financial advisors or people to leverage their expertise. So for me, all I knew was that I played rugby. I got paid, you know, my money, and that I needed to essentially use that money to the best of my capabilities. And when you don't have tools, at that time, when you think that you're a millionaire, as an 18-year-old kid, you think you're a millionaire, well, you spend it like it. So we were quite lucky. My father said that, and my mother did, they took all our money away from us, and they gave us a $200 fee for, you know, because my mum cooked. We got a car given to us by Audi. So we were lucky that we got given a car, and then we had to go to training. So we helped out with bills, but essentially we didn't need more than $200 because we weren't going out, we weren't doing much. So and then when we became 19 years old, we ended up starting a business where we bought property. And our first investment was we saw a big, I suppose, a townhouse. There was four townhouses. And both Anthony and I were like, how are we going to afford this? We thought it was a good opportunity. And my dad's like, oh, I've got all this money saved up from you guys. I think you should go do it. And then we went to the bank and they said, my father was Sayer Senior. So they said, Sayer, your boys want to, buy this block of units. Would you be happy to give up your house as guarantor? He's like, yeah, sure. And I'm like, I look now, I'm like, if I had an 18-year-old kid, 19-year-old kid, would I guarantor my house? I'd be like, no, why? No. That's the last person I want to talk to, like have any kind of equity. Like, what are these guys going to do? And he didn't even question, didn't even blink. And I was just like, I look now and I think how blessed we are as families because we are so tight. And, it doesn't matter if it's, I know that if I call up my brother Billy, I need $1,000 or I need $100,000. It doesn't matter. Like, I know the answer. Not what you need it for. Yeah, how much? I'll transfer it tomorrow. Send me the details. And I think we kind of lose that now because it's about the bottom dollar or how much interest you're making or, and I think as a family, that's probably why we were so successful, because we didn't sweat the small stuff. We worked super hard as a family. As a family dynamic. So, I remember in our house, there was always me and Billy and Anthony and Colby, and them two would always pass the ball every night. Then we'd go up and game, and then we'd come down or we'd watch some TV. Then we'd come down and start throwing the football around, and then, we'd do tackling technique. And I always say to people, I was like, how good is it to have your best mates as tackling partners? Because you bash the shit each other. Like, no one, like, we work so hard at like trying the best technique of how to tackle each other. So, like, that's probably why we're pretty prevalent tacklers, because we practice on each other, and you're going to be more effective on your twin, like on your twin brothers or your brothers, because you want to make sure you hurt them. Like, like my dad was like, if you're going to fight, go downstairs and run the ball at each other. Like, like proper old, like, go downstairs and sort it out, go run at each other. And I was like, oh, okay. So that's how we sorted out our disagreements, I guess.
Let's obviously an awesome testament to your parents for the support that they gave you, but also the lessons they brought you up, and not every, especially in terms of the Pacific Island, and because they just don't know that stuff that your parents were teaching you, and now we have that opportunity, like yourself with your children and me with mine, about actually teaching them around all that. Looking after your money, and it's not the typical, it doesn't grow on trees, what are you going to do with it, how can you make it work for you, and things like that. And that's I think that's a lesson that probably is a step that's missed back in our day, but obviously you got it, and it's great that you've been able to use that to build what you're doing. And just to hear you talk about it at such a young age, and like you said, it's no mean thing, no little thing, when your father actually says, oh, yeah, I'll be the guarantor, because, it does put a bit of pressure on you to make sure it all pans out.
And the worst, and I don't know if it's the worst thing, but what happened was is that we worked off the beer barter system, because my dad worked in a pub. So the boys, like all of our friends at school, they were all apprentices. So, one was a plumber, one was an electrician, one was a jack of all trades, more or less. He just come over for the beers. So, he would come and lay the carpets or come do the landscaping. But we worked off it, and it worked well. Like, we went to the land council. We had to learn how to strata houses. We had to learn how to get them every individual titles. We had to learn how to render. We had to learn, and it was a school of hard knocks. But it sent up the fundamentals of how to put, and it's like a team, project managing, people are good at things and people are not. So you know, why get a prop forward to do a second rowers job? Well, you don't do that, you know. And I think to correlate that into business, you know, we all have our strengths, we all have our weaknesses, but we need to make sure that the people that are good at what they do, so if that's accounting or financing or, you know, project management, or, you know, essentially doing BDM work, you know, business development, they stick in their lane and they do that and they do it to the best of their ability. And then we're going to see, obviously, reap the rewards, I guess.
That's also on you to understand your strengths and weaknesses first day, you know, that takes a while, because it's when you're starting, you think, I've needed to have control, so I want my finger in everything and I want to have a say in everything. So you've actually got to relinquish some of that, abdicate a bit of control and say, oh, actually, man, I don't know this, so I'm trusting you. And then you've found people that you can trust. And yes, and I think, you know, that probably in terms of the leadership that you've had in terms of rugby as well, and now in managing, that kind of come through. You've got to have some hard discussions sometimes, eh?
Well, I think when we had that leadership meeting with yourself a couple of weeks ago, and we talked about, you know, not giving people good news, and how did we go about it? You know, we're in a business where, you know, especially in a labour hire business, where sometimes people are not other people's cup of tea, so they get let go. So how do you tell that person when you think that they do a good job, or they think they're doing a good job, and they're just not suitable for that job? So, you know, it's articulating the wording that you tell them, but also making sure that they understand that, you know, like, that you might not be a labourer, you might, you know, be good at a recruitment, or you might be good at, you know, bookkeeping. But giving them the right avenues and the right tools for them to work it, and push them into the right direction, because no one wants to hear bad news. No. Let's be honest. Like, and everyone says, and we actually, I think we mentioned about, you know, not being picked in a team and then being picked, and, you know, oh, can you please give me feedback? I want more feedback. Let's have a coffee. And you can't always do that, you know. Well, and what are you going to say? You know, oh, you know, I think I'm better than this person. Well, at the moment, you're not, you know. And how do you tell people? You know, you either be straight and then they don't want to hear it because they go tell everyone else. And then in the company, the culture goes, and then, you know, then you've got to, you know, they're like cancer. And that spreads in the business. And, you know, we do have a lot of staff, so we have to be cautious of what we do, and we need to make sure we tread lightly with them kind of them conversations as well.
Yeah. I actually, funny you say that. I just had a chat with another business owner today, you know, and about the same thing, you know, around just like players, as coaches and now in terms of business, as leaders, you've got to give your workers everything that they can, you know, they need to – do the job that, you know, they're there to do, and you give them, you know, every resource that you can give them, you know. And sometimes, you know, that's just similar to a coach and a player. You give them every resource, and now it's up to them, you know, like, we've given you everything. But as you know, being someone that's been in that, you also, and from my point of view as being a player, then turning to coach, you're just giving them no way out. You're giving them no excuses. I says, I know, look, I've been where you are. I'm going to give you, I know what the excuses that are coming, so I'm just going to give you all these, you know, all these things to plug those holes. And he says, yeah, that's right. But then it also puts the onus on them. Well, I've got everything that I've asked for. You know, you ask them, what do you need? You give them everything. Now it's up to you to, you know, and then it's up to, you give them every tool to succeed. Then it's up to them.
Yeah, and I think especially in that labour hire business that we are and recruitment, you know, all we can ask for is giving them an opportunity that they didn't have before. That's all you ask for, you know. And as an owner of a business, we're giving you an opportunity to go deliver a job. If you don't do it, you know, you could become, you know, from sweeping the floor to project manager to recruiter to, you know, being a project manager. Like, I don't know, but that's up to you. We just deliver the opportunity. So for us, it's about making sure that their reality or their dreams meets their reality, because some people think that, you know, they should be getting paid $20. Sorry, people think they want to get $90, but they really only should be earning $20. And, you know, that's tough. And you know, and especially when you're in the trade world where, you know, tradies that haven't had, you know, especially in our business, you know, with carpenters or like Sparkies or, you know, people that are doing hoist driving, they're the first person to come up to and, you know, tell you to F off or nick off, and, you know, that they've got no filter, and they don't really care because they've been let down again. But it's not us letting you down. Like, we're just giving you a job. We're giving you an option. It's the contractors that are actually making the decision that don't want to contract you again or that don't ask you to come back. That's not our decision. Our decision is to place you and get you a job and give you an opportunity. And I think that was probably the big thing that rugby served us well, is that, you know, every year we live in a pandemic. So I always say to people, I'm like, you know, people go, oh, you know, it's been so tough. You know, I've lost my job. It's, you know, this pandemic. And I'm like, listen here. I go, since I was 14, since I had earned a wage, since I was 18 years old, I lived in a pandemic. Mm-hmm. They go, what do you mean? I go, well, okay, I earned $50,000 one year and I could have earned $80,000 next year. But if I play bad, that 50 grand goes into 30 grand. That goes into not having a job. I'm not an accountant. I don't go from job to job and I've got the capabilities with me and it follows me around.
Mm.
I can't go from, you know, being a project manager from one site and go, oh, you know what, I might go to another site next week because they're offering more money. Well, that doesn't happen. In rugby, you either play well and you earn more money, or you don't play that well and then you lose money, or you lose your job completely and they sign someone else better.
Mm. You're right. And you've got a definite use by date. Hey? That's
a scary thing.
Yeah.
Like people go, oh, you know, it must be good. You're making millions of dollars and you know, you're playing something you love. And I go, okay, well, listen here. After you pay your tax, you pay your agent fees, you know, and then you always got that anxiety feeling of, am I going to get injured? Rehabbing, the sacrifices you make for your family. You don't get to go to weddings. You're missing weddings. You miss out on Christmases. You miss out on, you know, all the christenings and parties and birthday parties. Is it really worth it? Well, if I'm selfish, yeah, I'm selfish. So, yeah, it is. But if you want to be a business person, you know, you get long, you know, you might get leave. You get sick leave. You get, you know, holiday pay. What is holiday pay? What is that? Like, you know, I didn't even know that, you know, you get 3 days off. You know, Easter's coming along. I might get a long weekend. What's a long weekend?
Oh, that's right.
You know, like we're 24/7. Mm. We have to eat well 24/7. You know, I look like a piece of junk. And I'll be the first person to admit it, that I was probably not the best looking athlete, I should say. But, you know, like you kind of have to always eat and present yourself and train hard all the time. Like you can't have 1 week off without doing anything, stretching, because when you get back, you might tear your hemi. Okay, you're out for 5 weeks. Well, the season starts in 4 weeks. Then, you know, then you're slow to go. And I just said to everyone, I always say to people, I'm like, we've lived in the pandemic. I understand how hard it is to understand that if I don't get this job or if I don't play, then guess what? Like maybe me and my family won't have the nice things that we've had. We have to save. We have to earn every dollar. So every dollar for us and every opportunity about either networking or working or doing things outside of rugby, that was our biggest thing. And I know that people, so all the rugby guys, they were always saying that St. Anthony's so shameless about like networking and, you know, getting out there. And you know what? Like I'm reaping the rewards right now. Because, you know what, I actually put myself out there. We did a good service, but also we were loyal. We were loyal to the Reds. We were loyal to the Brumbies. We were also loyal people. So when it comes to getting a contract, you know, I go to that person that I talked to at a, you know, at an after-match function and said, you know, oh, sorry, my name's Safienga. I met you at this gala dinner, or I met you at this function. Do you remember me? Not really. Oh, I'm the fat bloke with dreadlocks. Oh, yeah, yeah, I know you. You know, like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Say a thing. No. Yeah, 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 yeah. You know, and then you can start that conversation again. But if I didn't get out of my comfort zone and I stayed and kind of did my own thing, then, you know, maybe I wouldn't have that leverage. And then I've got to start again.
That's, again, that's awesome in terms of everyone that I've all spoken to and, you know, on these podcasts around sports people utilizing those networks, but you learned that early.
Yes.
A lot of us, and myself included, learned this late, not willing to get out of that, you know, being unapologetic. I think some people have said today, being unapologetic about who we are, and actually it's a win-win, you know, like you having this discussion with a sponsor or someone, like you said, that you remember where that gala dinner, well, it's a win-win for them. They get to utilize your profile and who you are, but also and the expertise that you've picked up after, you know, years in rugby. And while also, you know, you get something from them, you get a bit of knowledge, you know, possibly that it could lead to something else. So I think sometimes rugby players, it's we tend to, or you know, sports people maybe, we tend to think that there's only one person winning. Hey, you know, like, oh, I haven't got anything to offer. It's either usually, you know, I've got nothing to offer them. What have I got to offer them? And then there's the other side where probably, oh, no, then, you know, I'm way bigger than this. So, you know, I should go to see. But again, where you end up, you just don't know at the end of your sports career, because it can become fickle, injuries, you know, form, all these things become have to be taken into account. And so that's awesome in terms of like you getting to know that stuff. But you got into this stuff so early. It's just amazing. And I think I'd just like to go back to your early days, you know, being of Tongan heritage and also, you know, being Indigenous as well. You know, so what was that like living up in those two cultures? Because I'm really interested. I obviously know the Tongans, you know, they're similar to us. But in that, and being Indigenous as well and having that background, what was that like?
I suppose because we were half caste as well, like, you know, family or mob, what we say. So, you know, we do the same kind of things, you know. We all look after each other. We all hang out to each other. You know, like for me, we grew up in a pub. We grew up in a pub for, you know, four years of our life. And it wasn't the greatest pub either. It was, you know, a place in Queanbeyan. You know, it was pretty rough sometimes, actually very rough. But the thing that taught us about things is that, like, you know, either Tongan side or the Indigenous side, it's very similar. Everyone wants to be part of something. Mm. And my father and my mother were always big on, like, family. So, you know, if that was my extended mob or my extended Tongan family, they kind of all met in the middle where, you know, aunties and cousins and uncles, you know, or, you know, like everyone's an uncle, everyone's an auntie, like in mob or even if you're in Tongan family, like that's how it is, you know. But in obviously Tongan, you give everyone uma or, you know, hug. Like, you know, I just think for us, it didn't really matter because everything was family.
Mm.
And because we had a big family, so we all kind of treated that the same way, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And you said that your parents met in Yass, and was there a bit of a Tongan community? Because, you know, old hangers, old Dan Helangahu said, he said he's from Yass, and I thought, oh, you must have been the own Tongan family, but no, you said you're from
my mum and my uncle moved into Queanbeyan. And then my dad was working as a butcher. He came over, but typical Tongan, he came over as a baker, then became a butcher, and then ended up getting his blue card. So marrying my mum. No, I'm joking. he got his visa. So my mum always makes jokes about it as well.
Yeah,
so
nice.
But then obviously, yeah. So he, and then ended up marrying my mum. So, and staying. So,
yeah.
Oh. But we used to go for family trips. And my grandfather lived out there. And we used to go there all the time as young kids. And I suppose when we were school holidays, my mum and dad used to always send us out there with my grandfather. So all five boys would go out there. And let's just say my grandfather was good at the whip. So so lucky he had a lot of land out there, so make us run.
Oh, nice. And your time with the Brumbies, what's something that, like you said, you played with some, you know, I'm sorry, you were in contact with some of the greats there, you know, they've got a steeped in history. You know, what was it like, you know, rubbing shoulders with, you know, the likes of the Gregans, the Larkhams, you know, Joe Roff and, you know, Owen Finnegan? They're good men. I would know them off the field.
The best thing about them, they were so humble about, like, they were so humbling about teaching young guys the way. And the best thing about, most of them didn't get paid at the start. So they didn't get paid as athletes. And then, or if they did get paid, they were like the first generation. So they knew about the education. They knew all. And for someone like myself, like I said, like we didn't know any better. So we just thought we were millionaires because we saw John Lomu. We saw people like yourself. We saw them. We saw you guys, you know, playing for your country. We're like, we're going to be millionaires. But we didn't know that, you know, Joe Roth's, you know, one of the directors at the University at Canberra, you know, Gregan's got 25 restaurants. You know, you don't see that. And my biggest thing was such a big learning curve that, you know, they were so articulating with their words, and they had so much business opportunities that they, you know, the rugby was just a vehicle for them to service their other businesses. So to get them the networks, or to bring guys in to leverage potentially to say, you know, this is what I do for rugby, but, you know, can I get your business to for the coffee shop, or, you know, and I just thought it was such an amazing dynamic with the guys. You know, like Stephen Larkham, like Bernie, you know, one of the best coaches I've been coached by, one of the best players I played with, but also the biggest nerd I've ever met, you know, like, and, you know, he's so, like, he's so humbling because he treats everyone with the same respect.
Mm.
And then I'm like, well, and then you look at his CV and you're like, you know, what's this guy about? You know, like, he's so amazing. Surely he'd be arrogant, but he's not, you know. And then, you know, I just think, yeah, it's just, you know, the era that we grew up, it really taught us about, you know, the fundamentals of making sure that rugby's there, but it's not just the money. It's about playing for your country. It's about, you know, using rugby as a secondary vehicle, not your first vehicle to make money.
Yeah, nice, nice. We all know from the earth, goodness grows. Victual, New Zealand's own health and wellbeing supplement range with native and Pacific ingredients. Visit victual.co.nz and take your first step to help your goodness grow. I just wanted to say, you know, you've done your time in Canberra. How hard was the move to go to the Reds? Like I said, man, I've been to Canberra. No disrespect, bro, but the weather there, eh? It's never been nice to me when I go. I don't like the cold.
So I always say to people, you know, oh, don't do me like that. Right. What about Wellington? Wellington's the worst. Well, oh, come on, man.
What do you think I left?
Auckland? Oh, jeez, no. Like, Auckland's just as bad. So I suppose young kids, because we didn't know any better. So if you don't know, you don't know.
Yeah.
So when we first moved up to Brisbane, like, it was to be honest, it was the worst, because we'd gone from like a dry heat and like being hot for like 30 degrees and like we probably wouldn't train because it was that hot, to like 38 degrees and humidity and like I can't breathe. I don't even know where I am, like an exhaust. Like the first year, I reckon, you know, especially in summer, because we came from Canberra and then we moved in, we started a preseason. I don't even, it's a blur to be honest, because it was that hot. Like I think I, and because we're, the house that we had, we only had air conditioning in our rooms, not in the living area.
Yeah.
So we ate lunch. We had our breakfast in our rooms. Like it was just, and it was pretty bad to be honest. But the one thing that, like, obviously Queensland did for us is it showed us that it's such a beautiful place here. You know, we could drive 40 minutes and we could be on the beach, you know, go north or south. And, you know, where Canberra, we didn't have that exposure. But like I said, when we were in Canberra, we didn't know any better. So I honestly thought Canberra was the best place you could grow up. And I still believe that, you know, Canberra is the gift that keeps on giving, as in, you know, they've got great schools there. They've got, you know, great cafes, great wine, and that's about it. No, and great people. But, you know, I love my time there. Like St. Edmunds College had, you know, they had done so much for both Anthony and I and my family that, you know, I would never take away from Canberra, because they set the platform for us, I guess.
Oh, and you had some good times there, you know, winning the Super Rugby in 2011. Oh. What was that like? Did you expect it? I don't think many people did, no disrespect. Well,
yeah, like, let's be honest, the Crusaders had a pretty good team and we were just young, you know, young team, but I'll tell you, this is a pretty funny story, actually. So we were sponsored by Lexus, and they ended up buying like three tickets, and I think it was like 60 minutes to go. And he's telling me the story the week after. He goes, "Sir, you know, we went there to cheer the Crusaders because we thought you guys were going to lose." So what do you mean, mate? You're my sponsor. Like, what's going on here? Like, he goes, "Oh, mate, like, let's be honest. They had an absolutely crazy team. They had essentially a superstar team, and you guys were just young." And I was just like, "Oh, thanks for the support, but I really appreciate it." But yeah, it was funny, because I think we played the underdog card really well. And I think that's what you and McKenzie did. He put us, and I think he was probably one of the key factors, I reckon, why we won it, because you know, for an example, with Quade Cooper, why make him tackle if he's an attacking player? Mm. Put him in the back. You know, we had Ben Lucas, who's one of the, you know, is one of the best defenders at fullback. Why would you waste him? Jono Lance, like a great defender. Put them at the front. Put our best defenders in the front and our best attackers in the backfield or on the wings. And it just like things that he, you know, at the lineouts, you know, we always talked about if you know, say for that time, the Crusaders, you know, they had a pretty good lineout and they had an amazing scrum. Mm. So we worked out that if we only done a 2-second scrum, that we probably won't get a tight end. They probably won't get a tight end. You know, like it wasn't like we were matching. Like every time we had a scrum, we knew that we were probably going to get beat. So we had to adapt and we had to make sure that we adapted to what their strengths were. Okay, well, that's not our strength, but we'll adapt. We'll make sure we have 2-second scrum. We'll make sure that, you know, with the lineouts, we don't do quick lineouts because, you know, they haven't got the strongest lineout, but we have a strong lineout. So we wanted to work to our strengths for the better of that game, I guess. And I think even when we played the Auckland Blues, you know, we probably showcased that we're actually a better team than what we thought we were, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think that was in the semi-finals at Suncorp. And I think after that, then we had some really good traction around where we can go. But 100% no one thought, you know, probably 99% of the people in that stadium didn't think we were going to win.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of doubt in our room before we were going out. That's for sure as well. Like, I think my mom and dad, I don't know about my dad, but he's always optimistic. But there was a lot of doubt. But it's quite funny actually, because when talking about playing teams, and my dad used to, so we used to either play when we played the Brumbies or the Rebels, and because if Colby was playing against us,
yeah.
So imagine this small tongish old like man walking around, and he'd wear his Reg jacket, and then he'd wear his Brumbies pants or his Brumbies jacket and wear bright red pants and his red cap on. And I'm like, Dad, like, you got to pick one team, I guess. But he's like, I don't care, as long as they get the free kit. So he's walking around with Brumbies clothes. He's walking around with Rebels shirt. And I'm just like, man, imagine, like, you're seeing this guy. There's Reds and Rebels playing, and he's wearing both kit. You're just like, man, he's delusional, this guy. So, but it's quite
funny. He's just supportive, mate. He's sitting on the fence.
Yeah, oh no, he just gets a free kit. So every time he comes over, you know, we get all the latest kit. He's wearing the polos. I'm like, Dad, that's this year's polo. You can't wear it. He goes, oh, can you? Oh, and ask them for another one. Like, okay, mate.
So, oh no, love him. But like you mentioned, you and McKenzie. That's just again, innovation and strategy. You know, obviously, they're really strong strategically, and you know, you've played under Robbie Deans then not long after with Australia. What was that like? What was it like to have a Kiwi coaching, you know, the Wallabies?
It was, to be honest, it was a little bit strange. I like Dingo was a really good coach, but as a coach, to coach a national team, you know, it's a pretty privileged thing. So I think the best person should get the job, but you know, if you're an Australian, you probably should coach Australia. But then you look at the soccer coaches, you know, they're from different ethnicities. For me personally, Dingo was, he was a good coach and, you know, had a good track record with the Crusaders. But, you know, coming to Australia, we play a totally different game. And we have totally different players. You know, we're very structured. We're very, you know, you look at, you know, like, I suppose like the Kiwis at that time, you know, it was very unorthodox. You know, every time we play the Kiwis, it's very, you're playing against the Globetrotters. So how can you replicate the Crusaders and then the All Blacks Globetrotters into very kind of bulky machine in Australia where we kind of set piece to, you know, to first phase, second phase, to line out, you know, and that's what kind of got me a little bit, because obviously line outs and scrums and, you know, we kind of, as hookers, we kind of manipulate where it was like, we're going to have two people there, we're going to have four pods and we just play rugby. What do you mean just play? Like, we don't do that. So, it was a little bit different, but it was good because he brought a different light to Australian rugby as well on, you know, just the basics. The basics done well. You know, like getting a shoulder and having offload, practicing offloads. Like before, you know, coming from the Brumbies, that was so strict in, you know, why do the 50-50 pass?
Yeah.
Hold on to it. Where you know, Dingo was like, if it's on, throw it. Like, okay. Well, yeah, but you guys have been brought up to play that way where, you know, it's kind of manufactured.
Yeah.
So that was probably, yeah, probably some of the things that, you know, he brought in that, you know, now that you can see with the Fijians now, the Tongans, the Samoans, even, you know, some of the younger generation, they're starting to implement, like, you know, Young Tate for the Reds, the halfback. You know, he's throwing, you know, offloads. He's, you know, like, and it's good to see that, you know, we're not just like this big kind of robot now. We've got young kids that have got the skill set to throw an offload, a flick pass, or and they're happy to do it.
I think that's, yeah, like you say, I suppose that's when you think about the structure of the Brumbies and Australian game, that's, you know, when you played them, that's what I loved playing, because you're playing against a skill set. Eh? You know, you play against, when you're playing the Wallabies, you're playing against, you know, strategy and the tactics. They're very, you know, it's an intellectual game.
Yeah.
You know, because, chess. You know, you play against the Springboks. That's not to say that it's not as intellectual, but you know it's physical. You're going to be sore from it. When you play the Wallabies, you're going to be tired because you're going to be running around a lot and your ability to keep the ball alive, because they like to do that as well, eh? You know, they've analysed you to the nth degree, you know, and they know you're going to get challenged on some things that you didn't maybe even think about. And that's, yeah, like you said, eh, it's the game's changing now, and the ability to keep the ball alive. And we want an entertainment package, because that's what the game's about now, really. And do you still have any involvement in rugby now? Are you still involved with Reds? Or
to be honest, no. Like, there's probably the big reason why is because if I go back to rugby and if I am part of it, I want to give 100%. And because we're very busy with the businesses, like, I can't give 100%. And I've been asked to do coaching, like line-out throwing with some young players. And I'm like, well, me coming in there once a week, it's not going to change his throwing ability. Me coming in there three or four times a week, you know, consistency. That's all you want from a player. You know, I remember, you know, Nick Styles, Ewan McKenzie, they as soon as they came in, they're like, well, how many throws you throwing? You know, I had, you know, Les Kiss, or when I was at the Brumbies, like Laurie Fisher, for instance. These guys were saying you have to throw at least a minimum of 100 balls a day. And Laurie Fisher, like, they used to, when I first joined the Brumbies, I was more or less like lightning. I don't know where I'm going to strike next. You know, they don't know where the ball's going to go. It was shocking. And, you know, I used to get more nervous to go to training to throw because I was so nervous, because, you know, I had, you know, Mark Chisholm throwing the ball, David Giffen like throwing the ball at me because we hit him in the face. Or so then I had to adapt it and make sure that I understood what my skill was, but then refine it and have that consistency where it didn't matter who I was throwing to, because I backed my ability, but I backed that I'd done the work. And I think why I haven't gone back is because, or why I'm not really associated, you know, I'm more happy to do the speaking and do the peripheral stuff, but actually the schematics and getting into it, if I can't give 100% of my time and get the best out of the player for that period of time, then I can't use myself, and I wouldn't do that to the player because I know how much I needed as a player and how much I wanted from a coach. And if you can't do it to them, like, you know, you feel like you've let them down, but you've let yourself down because you promised and under-delivered.
Yeah. I'm just picturing you throwing it and, you know, those locks, throwing it back. Hey, but, you know, in this day and age, that's called feedback. It's just instant. That's all, eh?
Feedback, yeah. I wish, like, they gave me good feedback. So I remember, like, some of the times the boys would just get the ball and, like, I'd hit him, like, at the chest and I'd just throw the ball, make me run after the ball.
Yeah.
Like, the disrespect, like, or, like, you know, like they know that you're having a bad day, eh? And then they throw the ball across the ground on the water. And you're just like, come on, man. Like, it's a tough day already. You don't need to. Yeah. But I think that was probably the best. Like, at the Brumbies, that taught me resilience. It definitely taught me resilience down there, because there was no prisoners, because they worked so hard on the detail. And they were, you know, and that was such a set piece team. So you knew where you were going to be in six phases.
Yeah.
So I remember getting George Gregan's eyes because I was on the second from the end when I should have been the third on the end. Like, and I'm like, mate, it'll be all right. Like, let's just play. And he's like, "Say, that's not the play." And I'm like, "Okay, George. Okay, like, you know, like,
yeah."
But it was one person out, but we were so structured, and you know, you didn't want to kind of mess up. So then you had to learn the rule book, and you know, you wanted to make sure, you know, that was, you know, I suppose you didn't want to get yelled at. And it wasn't so much from the coach, it was the players.
Yeah.
So then I suppose in business now, we want to make sure that who's accountable. Like, obviously we're accountable as bosses, but also they keep each other accountable.
Mm.
So all departments keep each other accountable, because at the end of the day, you're only as good as your last win, or, you know, allocation, or if we do a fit out, you know, if we have defects or we're not potentially servicing that client as well as we could, then we're going to lose that job.
Yeah.
And I think how rugby has put me into, you know, I suppose in a better life in construction and the furniture and the labor is because you never want to let other people down. So if you give them 100% and you at least try and do the best, then, you know, all you can have is your word and your bond, but also, you know, guess what? You know, I didn't do that right. Or yes, he made a wrong mistake, but you know, we'll come back to you. And at least you've tried, and at least you've given them the respect that they earn instead of doing it half-assed. And then guess what? You know, everyone looks like an idiot, and then it's your company that goes down, and then you end up not doing a great job. And then guess what? You probably lost that contract.
It's funny, yeah, with when we were both in Toulon, I got to see that those eyes you're talking about.
Eyes.
Oh, when someone didn't place the ball right, or someone sat over and he had to reach, he walked off the field one time just because, you know, he got bumped into someone that got counter-rucked and hit him, and he threw the ball down, and or he threw it back at the guy. Nah, that's not good enough. Let's go do it again. And I was going, oh, geez. I thought I was bad.
I remember they wanted to do an extra session, and George didn't want to do the extra session. He's like, yeah, we won't be doing that session. And I'm sitting there as a youngster. I was like, yeah, we won't be doing that.
I'm with him.
And he's so small, and you're like, yep, I'm with him. So,
yeah, 100%.
But the best thing, you know, then, and when I first started, he was like, he'd always bring his own stretching equipment, and he brought his authority, but also he brought, you know, so much. Yeah, but he was an ultimate professional.
Mm.
So his expectations of everyone else should have met them expectations.
Yeah.
So if you didn't meet that, then you're half-assed doing it. And that's what one thing that I met when I was obviously playing and doing the things with him, his expectations on people were that they were his expectations on himself.
Mm.
So he would never expect things of other people if he didn't expect them himself.
Mm.
And I thought that was such a privilege to play with someone and also be a part of it, because he was also like, he was really, really great advocate of, you know, he'll never preach something that he wouldn't do himself.
Yeah.
And that's the same with Stephen. Like, yeah, and he's a good man. Yeah,
and they're good men. Hey, I did want to ask, Munya, where does that come from? Munya and Maji.
Yeah, so Munya and Maji mean, so Munya itself means safe house. So in Bangjalan Mob. So Bangjalan is where we're from. So yeah. my grandmother's from. Awesome. And that means safe house. So the actual design is, obviously, mob, family, whatever.
Mm.
It's a circle, and it's a circle with what we call a table and seats around it. And it doesn't matter if you've come from different upbringings. Doesn't matter the color. Doesn't matter what ethnicity you are. And it doesn't matter if you're educated or not. So wherever you're from, you're inclusive. Like, you're included in any kind of conversation. So we want to be a company where there's an opportunity for you to always sit at the table. So it doesn't matter if you're the director or you're sweeping the floors. Everyone has a right to sit at the table. So both Anthony and I, our big beliefs is that, you know, we give people opportunities to sit at the table, and it's your opportunity to take it.
Oh, and Maggie is?
It all kind of means the same. It's like collectiveness, okay. But it's the same kind of Maggie Munya.
Yeah.
The same kind of concept. So if you have a look at, it's like a wavy one without the seats.
Yeah.
A wavy circle, but essentially it's a table where everyone's invited to the table and everyone's equal. Oh. No one's bigger than anyone else.
Oh, that's awesome. I think, you know, we've talked a lot about some footy and some business, but can you let us in on maybe some of the failings that you've had, you know, on your journey? There mustn't be many, surely.
There's a lot. you know, I'd probably say, like, you know, chasing down opportunities that you know, it burned lots of money, I guess. You know, investing in people that, investing in people that were the wrong person for that job. Mm. You know, probably one of the biggest learnings, you know, probably having too much on your plate. You know, being overexposed.
Yeah.
You know, at the moment, you know, we do a lot. So if we don't, you know, trying to micromanage, and that costing the business because you are trying to micromanage and you're exposed everywhere.
Yeah.
When, you know, the person that you've told to do that direction and lead that and be the champion of that role, you know, someone calls you about that decision and then you override the person that's supposed to be delegate or head of that division.
Mm.
So there's some of the things, that biggest learnings. But also I think one of the biggest things I think I've learned is, you know, cash flow and making sure that you've got money in the bank, making sure that, you know, picking up the low hanging fruit and not going for all the big, you know, the big jobs, because at the end of the day, you know, cash flow is king. And for a business like us, we're all about making sure that we have money coming in the door. That's whatever's coming in that month. There should be money left over. Mm. But if there's more money going out and nothing coming in, then, you know, as a company, we're hurting.
Yeah.
So how do we mitigate that risk? So we always talk about, you know, we're always looking at our P&Ls. We're always looking at, you know, where we can either sharpen the pencil or where we can cut costs. You know, if that's on personnel, if that's on, you know, on the actual job, or if that's actually turning down jobs because we're not going to make that margin and the job's too long or it gives us too much exposure in jobs. So for us, you know, the learnings are, it's a journey on the learn, you know, on the learnings, and we're always learning and we're always trying to pivot and we're always trying to work out ways to grow our business, but we're also trying to also consolidate, as in, you know, with the labor hire for an example, or the traffic control. We're only in two sectors. We're in construction sector and we're in civil sector. You know, we wanted to go into mining sector, but that's a whole kit. Like, you know, we started going down that and, you know, we started burning money because we were going through EBAs. We're starting, we're going through, you know, agreements and lawyers fees, and we couldn't go down that section because it was too big and the margins are too small.
Yeah.
So then, you know, we've stayed in our, you know, resourcing and the sectors that we're good at, and we're making good margins, and, you know, we're not burning money on agreements and trying to get in and leveraging, you know, potential clients or, you know, potential, you know, governments or spend, because we know what we know here. So, you know, the one thing that I will say, like any successful business has to have a good balance sheet or good cash flow.
Mm.
Nice. And I think, you know, speaking to you about this last week, you know, when we talked about leadership and we talked about, you know, roles. Mm. So one of our business partner, Walter Hawkins. Mm. So Walter, all he does is he looks at our expenditure, our cash flow, and he gives us an update every week about where we're exposed, where we're not, where the money's coming in, where the money's coming out. But he doesn't burden us with when we're doing it tough.
Mm.
But he burdens when we're in the middle to make sure that, okay, say, like, you know, we need to do more sales here, or, you know, we're a little bit down here, or, you know, but at least we've got visibility. And when it's out of sight, it's out of mind. So if you don't know, you don't know. So if you play that, the, you know, in rugby, it's, you know, and I think we talked about as well about being a manager. So you let your manager deal with it. So because you don't hear about it, you know, so say you're a bit overweight this week and, you know, he's playing terrible, but we'll just give him the money, but he's worth 50 grand less, you know.
Mm.
I didn't hear it, so I'm feeling good. I've put on weight, but I feel really good, but really, like, it's shit weight.
Yeah.
And, you know, you need to pull your socks up and you need to be on the treadmill running.
Mm.
But because, and as Pacific Islanders, you don't want to hear bad news. You don't want to, you know, it's true, but you don't really want to have them, that tough conversations. And to be honest, no one wants to hear them, but if it's out of sight, it's out of mind. So, you know, especially with money, I'm doing really well. Well, then if you're doing so well, then, like, how's your balance sheet? Where's this going? Or, you know, or actually I didn't know about this, or, you know, my bash is due, or the superannuation issue, or, well, I didn't know about that. Well, you're in debt 100 grand or 100, like $1 million. Like, well, I didn't know about it, so I'm not paying. Well, that's not how it works.
No, exactly.
And I think, you know, that comes back to down to, like, you know, I suppose rugby, and you know, leaving your manager to deal with it with all the problems. But it's got to start with you. Like, if you don't know about you're overweight, or, you know, if you're not, you know, fit enough, or, you know, you've slowed down, or, you know, you're not, you know, you haven't been doing your extras. Mm. You know, your line out, like my line out or my scrummaging is going down. I need to know about it. Don't, like, as a manager, like they smoke, they give you smoke and mirrors, but sometimes you just need some pure honesty.
Mm. Yeah, and they got to realize too, the manager's there. He works for you, not the other way around.
Correct.
So, hey, like, yeah,
and I spoke at length with like someone like Sukopi Kepu, talking about, you know, your manager, he works for you. Like, he should have your best interest.
Mm.
So remember that when he picks up the call to call you, like, he doesn't get charged. Like, you should charge him. Like, you know, he should be, you know, making sure that everything you do and everything your agent does, that's for you.
Mm.
Like, it's not the other way around. Like, you shouldn't be happy to call him. Like, mate, he should be calling you every day, making sure you're right, making sure your boots are, making sure you've got joggers, making sure your family's safe. Mm. Like, he's working for you. Where sometimes these agents, you know, like, and no, like, you know, they do a great job, but sometimes they need to be like, pull up their socks, because, you know, there's these young players that, you know, they're so scared because they think their agent's going to make or break them, or get them this big deal because, you know, they're doing well. Well, actually, you're playing really well, so you deserve that $1 million, or you deserve that 50 grand.
Mm.
You know, like, penny pinching from young kids.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Look, and like you say, it's understanding that there's some accountability on their part as well. Not, you know, so, but again, these young players, they just don't know that. They don't know what questions to ask. They just think, this guy's, he's doing me a favor by being my manager and he's going to look after me. But don't forget as well, you're on a stable of 200. So you're one of 200, no, you know. So, hey, so what does the future hold for you guys?
So we have a plan, I suppose, for workforce, for workforce. So I don't know if we talked about it last time. So we want to become one of the first Indigenous companies for labour hire traffic control to be listed on the stock market.
Yeah.
So that's our goal.
Yeah.
And yeah, people always, you know, go like, how do you set that goal? It's so high. It's out of reach. And I go, well, I grew up in a town called Queanbeyan. We have a family of five. We had a gross income of $31,000 between the seven of us. You know, my mum, my dad, and us five boys.
Mm.
And we lived in a pub. And, you know, we had aspirations to play for the Wallabies. So, you know what? I played for the Wallabies. So you can't tell me. And we went to a private school. We had opportunities on the way.
Mm.
So is that out of reach? Not at all.
No.
Because I've lived and dreamed it. So that's what holds. And then I also want to take good people on the journey. So that's, you know, our end goal is to take the crew, the staff that we have now, and our, you know, our directors and our employees. We want to take them on a journey where, you know, we do it tough and we go through the bumps and we do the ebbs and flows, but collectively, you know, 10 years time, 8 years time, we want to be on the stock market.
Oh, that's awesome. And so you're a busy man, you know, and you seem to have something on all the time. So how do you take care of your own health and well-being?
It's a good question. I suppose, you know, as a rugby player, you the only thing you do is take care of your well-being, and you're so selfish. As a business owner, it goes to other people. So your staff, it goes to, you know, you're a bit like yourself, like a coach. Like you give so much of your time to everyone else except yourself.
Yeah.
You know, we have a thing where, you know, every, you know, we try and go to training every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, where we spend an hour of self-well-being. So we go to the gym either in the morning. So we start at 4:30 in the morning. So me and Leon, we go to the gym at 4:30. We go for a walk, or we're always doing some kind of self-assessment, I guess.
Mm.
And I think that comes to, you know, when you first rock up to training and you do your sit wall test, you do your knees, you know, you do that, you know, how's your body feeling, and making sure you've – so usually Monday, Wednesday and Fridays, we usually do the tester. So we usually go for a walk, or we're doing some form of exercising. But also you know, I'm not ashamed to say that, you know, I also see a counsellor. And I, the reason, you know, I say to people, you know, I always get odd looks as well. Like, you see a counsellor, like, you know, you're a busy person, you do all the, and I said, well, I look at myself like as a vehicle. Mm. You know, you're a car, you know, you have to be serviced. Otherwise, I don't want to run the car into, you know, like essentially run it into the ground and, you know, the wheels fall off and the engine blows. Like, I have to see someone. I have to talk about our problems or my problems. I need to talk about my family life. I need to talk about the business life. I need to talk about, you know, how I am actually genuinely feeling. Mm. And, you know, I think at rugby, what I learned is that, you know, you only, if you're not good, then how can you be good for other people?
Yeah.
So how can I be the best rugby player or the best director or the best owner of a company if I can't even get myself right?
Mm.
So if that's coming into work and not being able to fulfill the capabilities of my role, then how can I give my, how can I have that expectation on staff?
Oh, no, that's awesome. And, you know, great honesty in terms of, you know, I think we always need someone to talk to outside, you know, our, you know, family, friends, just so you get a different, you know, different feedback and feel like you're getting some things, so like you say, a good tune-up in terms of your own mental well-being, because we know how important that is at this stage.
And then, I think men in general always hire away from it. You know, we're too good, or we don't want to get tested, or we don't want to, you know, I just think that, you know, I think it's crucial in what we do in life now that, you know, there's so many people losing their lives for mental health. So why can't we, what is an hour out of your life to see someone or do a Zoom and talk about your mental health, talk about what issues you have. And that's from getting up in the morning to feeling, you know, going home and, you know, I had a bad day or I've had a bad week. Why?
Mm.
Let's have a chat about it. And not being your partner because you don't want to burden her. Mm. Or I'm just keeping it, you know, I don't want to burn my kids or, you know, I'm always angry. Let's talk about it, you know, and getting the right tools so that next time it happens, then you can mitigate, you know, we have the right tools. Let's work through it, Sal. So that's, So I think it's quite big now, and I'm a big believer in making sure that we see the right people as well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And as you say, as men, you know, we're meant not to have problems or we're meant not to show weakness yet. We actually are, and we've got to have a bit of vulnerability to open up and share that with people. So it makes us feel better. We don't have to feel the burden of carrying around these, you know, these issues that we might have.
Yeah.
Hey, brother, I know you're still in the middle of preparing your fit out there.
I'm just at the RSL club. The guys are on site, so I'm wondering there's no drilling or anything.
You've done awesome, mate. You've done awesome. Thank you. Thank you for your time and sharing your stories with us, because it's been bloody insightful for me, and just hearing your great stories and your awesome family as well. So I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, my lord. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to check out Victual's website at www.victual.co.nz so you can rebalance your lifestyle with ancient wisdom and ingredients.